into the forecourt, gives it to George, driving hard to the hoop, sends it outside to Miles and into the corner, where Robinson gives the Pacers the lead with a huge three-point field goal, the biggest of his career. Indiana by one with 0.6 seconds to play.
Hello and welcome. This is another Sideline Guys podcast. I'm Pat Boylan, Pacers radio host and sideline reporter with us. Jeremiah Johnson, TV host and sideline reporter with the All-Star break, the road trips. It's been a while since we've gotten to do one of these a couple feet from each other. It's good to see you in person.
Good to see you, Pat. I will say, though, that our chemistry over the computer seems to be pretty good because my mom was talking to me about the podcast. She, no surprise, is a big-time listener. In fact, I think sometimes she listens twice to make sure she catches everything, but she says she's surprised at the chemistry that I have with you and how we get along so well on the podcasts. And most of those, we're not even seeing each other when we talk. So it's good to see you, and I felt like coming to the field house today. This is Wednesday morning as we tape this prior to Pacers Pistons. It was a little bit unusual because if you consider the All-Star break, just one home game in really the last two or three weeks. So it's been an unusual schedule, the five straight road games, a trip home in between that. But now it's going to tilt, maybe the schedule tilts to the Pacers' favor just a little bit with some succession of home games.
Yeah, I was looking. I think this is game number two at home in 20 days. They'd played just one home game in 19 days previously. And we're aware that we are taping this here on Wednesday afternoon, and this podcast will get up probably Wednesday a little bit later afternoon. So we're aware that there's a good chance when you're listening to this, the Pistons game has already happened. So we're going to talk a little bit about the Detroit game coming up today, but try to keep this more general based. The road trip just getting done, a five-game road trip. You guys were able to split it up 3-2. 2-3 doesn't necessarily jump out as a big success or anything like that. Really outside of the second half in Miami, a pretty over first half in Charlotte, second half in Miami. Otherwise, and I know you can say you take out the bad play and they played good, played well, but you saw a lot of good things, I think, on the road trip.
I prefer to just, instead of call it a road trip, just since the team did come home in the middle, it's the games after the All-Star break, because I'll lump that home game against Memphis in the first game after the break in with the last five on the road and say 3-3 since the break, and looking at the schedule and who you played and saying, you know, you've got some pretty good wins. And I don't know even if the most optimistic of Pacers fans during the break when you were facing a six-game losing streak, if you'd have said, you know, I think they have a great chance to be 5-1 in those six games. Even 4-2 would have been phenomenal. And after that win against Atlanta, if you could have gotten the win against Charlotte, then all of a sudden you'd look at the next three or four games and say, man, they can put together a nice 5 or 6 game win streak. But as we've seen with this team throughout this season, just when you think they've got it, maybe they take a step back. And I don't think that the Charlotte game is a reason to slam your hand against the panic button. It was a game where Charlotte knows they've got to go on probably a 7 or 8 game win streak, or win 7 of 8 if they realistically hope to get into the playoffs. So they're almost facing that desperation type of situation in their season. The Pacers were the one that were playing on the second half of the back-to-back, and Charlotte had been on the road for a long period of time. That was their first game back at home, and that's always, you know, sometimes you could say that's a tough game for a team. But Charlotte, given the circumstances and where they're at, they absolutely had to win that game. I know the people down there, I tend to not really care too much if a game's on TNT or ESPN, but I think the folks in Charlotte were excited about having that TNT game on Monday. And so, you know, the Pacers got off to a slow start, and that was a situation where you could not get off to that kind of start and come back against Charlotte. They did come back and make it somewhat interesting, got it down to single digits, but all of the energy it took to get back into that game, and I think Charlotte probably relaxed just a little bit. So I talked a lot more maybe about that one game, the last game of those six, than maybe you would have liked, Pat, but I do think that over the last six, 3 wins, 3 losses, a big-time win at Houston, an exciting win in Atlanta, and maybe a game you should have had against San Antonio, I think they're in a position now to make a solid push and even make a run at 5. I mean, I know right now 7 and 8, the Pacers are only one game up on Chicago and Detroit, but I think that 5 is a possibility here with about a month and a half to play.
I guess I looked at the road trip like this. The Houston and the San Antonio games on the road are going to be extremely difficult to win. You're talking about two of the top three teams in the Western Conference, probably two of the top four teams in the NBA. Playing them on the road, going to be very difficult to win. So if you drop those two, then you got to take 2 out of 3 against Atlanta, who's good, and you've got two desperate teams in Miami and Charlotte. Miami less desperate, but they're on a huge streak, the hottest team in the NBA. Charlotte certainly getting to the point where they're desperate. You add in that Memphis game, you played six games since the break, and 3-3 I think is a plenty fine result. Six games, four are against teams you would say are good or very good, and two are against teams who one is playing really well and hot, the other needs to start winning now or their season's going to be over sooner rather than later. And we were talking about a month ago in early February about how the Pacers have the toughest schedule in the NBA going forward. That was right around where the seven-game winning streak was ending, the six-game losing streak was starting. The good news on that stat, that note, is the reason they had the toughest stretch in the NBA going from February 8th on out is because of the stretch that they just completed. Now, their stretch the rest of the season isn't easy. They've got tough teams left to play. Cleveland's still in there. You look at the schedule, a lot of difficult teams. But going forward here as we hit this stretch, 19 games to go as of taping of this podcast, their opponents are 500 exactly, and they have exactly the 15th toughest schedule in the NBA. So right about average for the rest of the way, and an opportunity here going forward as the competition lessens a little bit to perhaps show their worth at the back half of the season.
And a couple of the individual areas or maybe statistics that we've been watching all season, they've made significant strides. And I know you talked with Nate McMillan after shoot-around on Wednesday about the rebounding, and that's a really positive development with this team in these games since the All-Star break, because they've played some teams that are used to dominating on the glass, and the Pacers have held their own and even for the most part out-rebounded opponents. And the other thing that I think is very promising is that after a difficult stretch scoring-wise for Paul George, the last two games you're seeing the kind of player that can almost put a team on his shoulders. And if he can stay fresh and have fresh legs and stay healthy and kind of have that offensive confidence, this team can beat anybody. And so I think those are two areas that as you look to the final 19 and maybe just specifically games here against teams that you're fighting for playoff positioning with, you like both of those situations.
I might go as so far to say that the two biggest keys to the Pacers closing strong, getting a good playoff spot, and having a chance at making some noise in the playoffs, I might go so far to say is the two biggest keys in no particular order are Paul George getting back to that all-star level and rebounding at least to a point where it's not killing you. And the Pacers have only been out-rebounded since the All-Star break one time in those six games, which to me is huge. It gives you a chance to win, and when this team has had a chance to win, more often than not, they have won. The stat that I really like, and this is interesting in two aspects. One, they struggled a lot in close games last year. They led the league, I think, in close games, depending on where you make the metric, 5 points, 3 points, games in overtime. They were near the top and or leading the league last year in those games. They're playing, now they're at the bottom. They're playing in so few games that are decided in the final moments. We've seen a couple of those since the All-Star break, but they're 4-1 in games decided by three or less this season, and we know what the one was. It was the one where Kawhi Leonard shuffles his feet eight times before taking the game-winning shot.
Eight times.
I don't think
it was quite the Shaq and a Fool style travel. No. And given this, I was watching it right from under the basket, and so I was kind of blocked. The stanchion had his feet covered, and so when it immediately happened, I saw Nate McMillan and some of the players upset, and I initially didn't see the travel and didn't even, for the postgame show that night, I didn't even really harp on it as much as maybe it deserved, because it just seemed like a great shot, because Paul pretty much defended him, and you had a fadeaway, and when it was in the air, I just knew it was going in. But yeah. I'm with you on the travel.
And look, I'm not saying that cost him the game. There were a lot of things.
It did technically did cost him the game.
Right, but there were multiple areas, of course. Ellis missing a couple free throws. The Pacers had chances down the stretch and weren't able to do that. Really, to have a chance to win in San Antonio, I think, is all you can ask for. But, yeah, the one loss in a quote-unquote close game this season, a game decided by 3 points or less, came on a play where the NBA said that play that won the game for the other team shouldn't have happened. So it goes back, I think, to the point where the Pacers have gotten a lot better in close games. They're not playing in as many of them. But really, a trend we've seen all season in general, when they've had a chance to win in games, they've done well. When the rebounding hasn't put them in a position to where they're giving up 10 extra possessions a game. You know, when you get out rebounded, the reason rebounding and turnovers are like this too are so tough to overcome when you don't do it well is because if you get out rebounded, say, by 8 in a game, well, it's like giving the other team maybe not exactly eight extra possessions, but like five or six extra possessions. And if you say, okay, you're going to play a game and you're going to have 90 possessions, you're going to have 90 chances to score, and the other team's going to have 96 chances to score, well, you might score on a higher percentage of your 90, but if they're getting more opportunities, it's going to give other teams chances to win. So I think your point was very solid. Paul George playing well right now. The team's rebounding well right now. And to me, I think those are the two biggest keys going forward.
And just to follow up on the rebounding, the one game they were out-rebounded, I have the box score in front of me, was no surprise the worst game of those six, the game against Charlotte, where you just look at the totals and you see 50-41, but you see 13 offensive rebounds compared to just six for the Pacers. And sometimes you can go into a game, and I know there are some coaches in the analytic-driven world that they don't emphasize offensive rebounding. They would rather their guys get back and play defense because they don't want to give up fast break points. But 15-9 was the total on second chance points, so there are just 6 points. You lose by 12. But the biggest stat from that game is probably the free throw shooting, and I don't think that the Pacers, you know, that was not one where the officiating cost the Pacers. They just did not attack the basket. Charlotte played great defense. 21 free throw attempts for Charlotte, just 3 for the Pacers. And one final note on the close games, and this is something that's interesting, I think, is a lot of times people will evaluate just how good a team is compared to another, and they'll look at point differential. And so the Pacers, despite being sixth in the Eastern Conference at the time of this recording, they're -1 in point differential. Teams 9, 10, and 11 all have positive point differentials, Miami, Milwaukee, and Charlotte. So that would lend some credence to the fact that, you know, if you just looked at point differential, you'd say maybe the Pacers, Heat, Bucks, Hornets, maybe they're not that much different. But winning those close games, that's all you do. All you want to do is win. You have to hope that if given the opportunity in close games, which you would expect to have over these final 19 with some of these games against teams that are really fighting for things, you've got the Bucks twice, you've got Miami again, you've got Charlotte again, you've got this final game against the Pistons. You'd think those are going to be some close games. If you can continue to have success in close contests, you're going to be right there solidly 6, 7, maybe 5 in the Eastern Conference.
Yeah, and do you go back to that point differential stat? I don't remember exactly where it finished last year, but the Pacers were flipped of that story. They had a good point differential for most of the year. I don't remember where it ended, but for most of the year, the Pacers had a better point differential than their standings might suggest they should be, and it was because they were losing more close games than they were winning, and then the wins, of course, were blowouts. The ones that they were winning were games by a larger differential. So, you know, going forward here, the opportunity, the ability to win in close games, the confidence. If we had a podcast last year, a topic that we probably would have discussed a lot are, you know, they get in these late game situations, and the first thing you think about is, oh my gosh, every time we've been in these scenarios, it's led to an unfavorable result, and that can kind of compound on itself. And at least this year, when they've gotten in these situations, they haven't won every close game, but I mean, look at the poise even in a loss. In San Antonio, they were down, I think, like 5 with 3 minutes to go or something, and came back and gave themselves a chance to win. You're down 6 with 2 minutes to go against Atlanta, and you do win that game. So those are what the playoffs are more like, and that, I think, is promising going forward. And we'll see here. These games coming up are obviously big because the season's winding down, and the Eastern Conference from, you know, 5, even maybe a touch above 5, is still very reachable. But at the same point, you're playing these teams around you. Detroit tonight, for example, the Pacers win, and you've got a 2-game gap between Detroit, and you're going to have the tiebreaker either way. The Pacers lose, and they're even with Detroit. They still have the tiebreaker, but these next handful of games could decide whether in the final stretch they're playing to try to move up into the 5 and solidify the 6, or whether they're fighting, you know, for their playoff lives. I think 538, the statistical website, gives the Pacers a 70% chance of making the playoffs, which is good at this point. And their magic number to make the playoffs this year, they're projecting it in the East at 40, which the Pacers would have to go 8-11, I think, the rest
of the year. I'll probably wait till it gets to the teens to start broadcasting it.
Agree. But that's just kind of a forecast at what you're looking at the rest of the way. The schedule eases up some. The Pacers are in a good position, but they've got to take care of business against these teams around them. They have done that against Detroit, but another opportunity coming up.
Yes, an opportunity and a good game with Paul George having some success against the Pistons. But some of these late close games earlier in the season, maybe even a month ago, I can remember we were talking about Paul George's ranking in late close situations, and his field goal percentage was, I think, 2nd in the NBA, 2nd to LeBron. And someone else who's the best clutch 3-point shooter, And that's maybe not necessarily clutch, quote-unquote, but second-half three-point shooting is C.J. Miles. And you've seen Paul making plays late. You saw C.J. make that big shot against Houston. So if you've got guys who've been there and done that, then you're in a good situation. At the other end, I'd like to see maybe a little bit better free throw shooting in late and clutch situations, and not to bring up the Monte Ellis situation against San Antonio, but there have been some other situations in the last couple of weeks where the team that was the best free throw shooting team in the NBA has fallen off a little bit. So you hope the confidence is still there from guys who, obviously, they know how to knock down free throws, but Monte struggled a little bit from the line. Thaddeus Young is struggling shooting right now with his left wrist injury. And I think Miles Turner is kind of struggling a little bit from the field, maybe not necessarily from the line as well. But so there are some guys that hopefully they can find some rest and some confidence, and they'll be in a good situation moving forward.
The free throw line is extremely interesting right now. You touched on it a few minutes ago very quickly. Just three free throws attempted back in that game against Charlotte. We just got done talking to Nate about it, and he addressed it and felt like they weren't being aggressive enough. And in fairness, I at least don't think I saw or heard anybody blaming the officials for that. It was not attacking the rim enough, probably not being aggressive enough. You fall behind, you need to shoot the three more kind of thing. But three free throws attempted is a franchise low, and it's compounded when you've got percentage-wise the best or up there throughout the season, the best free throw shooting team percentage-wise in the league. That's a huge advantage that Indiana has, because all their guys, especially in the starting lineup, are good. Jeff Teague's a really good free throw shooter. Obviously, C.J. Miles can do it. Paul George is flirting around with the best free throw percentage in the NBA. Thaddeus Young has struggled this year, and his wrist hasn't helped, but we know that Thad can shoot it. And when your center is Miles Turner and he's shooting it about making three out of every four or so, when you can get that from your center position, it's a huge advantage. So I think another key going forward is, look, they're not going to have another three free throw attempted game, but how much can they take advantage of what already is an advantage? Because I think on attempts, they're somewhere between like 20 and 23. I haven't checked it exactly heading into today, but they're somewhere in the early 20s in free throws attempted. So they're hitting them, but they'd probably like to get to the line more.
They're a team that settles, you know, for more mid-range jumpers than I think most teams do in the NBA. I tend to not be someone who panics about that, because they've got a lot of guys who that's a really good shot for them. To a guy like Rodney Stuckey or Monte Ellis, that's kind of their sweet spot. I'd rather have them shoot the mid-range jumper than a layup, because sometimes they go in there amongst the trees and they're unable to finish. And I like Miles Turner shooting those, maybe except for the last couple of weeks. I'd like to see his confidence get back. And back to Paul George and the free throws, I feel like we're bouncing around a little bit, but some of these themes are repeated. How crazy was it that Paul had 36 points and did not have a free throw attempt? When you see the guys around the NBA, and we're seeing the stars do it with regularity, every single night you just look at the recaps or the box scores and you see somebody with 40. And just last night you had Russell Westbrook with 50. So I was just curious, you know, he doesn't have a 50-point night without having free throw attempts. He had 58 points, 13 for 16 from the free throw line. For Paul to have a 36-point night when coming into the game, or at least maybe prior to the Atlanta game, his field goal shooting was not good over the last couple of weeks. To have a 36-point night, to not really force it, I'll say 25 attempts, it didn't feel like he was forcing the shots. You know, he had 14 threes. That probably is, without even doing some research, I'm sure that's a season high in three-point attempts, but he knocked down six of them. But to have 36 and not go to the free throw line, I mean, that's a 50-point night for some of the way some of these stars play and getting to the free throw line in double-digit attempts. So I like where Paul is. I like kind of the mindset that he's taken over the last few games. And as long as his teammates can be there and learn, if Paul's going to have 25 attempts, you know, there are some nights when he's having 12 attempts or 13 attempts. If they don't lose track of the offense, if they don't kind of lose some of their confidence with Paul having more attempts, I think they'll be okay.
I want to get your thoughts on what we might see for the rotation going forward. It seemed like a major theme of this season is guy has gotten hurt, and then guy who hasn't been playing as much, let's use Monte Ellis, gets hurt, Glenn Robinson comes in and plays well in his stead, then that guy shows he's deserving of minutes. Remember, Glenn Robinson, the third start of the season out of the rotation, and now he's playing. He played 28 minutes against Charlotte. He hit the biggest shot of the game against Atlanta. He started a lot of games this year. We've seen a bunch of guys who have been out of the rotation move their way up into the rotation, from rotation to starters minutes back. And another example, Al Jefferson, he gets hurt. Rakeem Christmas comes in, plays well. Lavoy Allen has been hurt. Rakeem Christmas has been getting – it's moved around. He had 9 minutes against Charlotte, but he has been part of this rotation. We don't know the story on Lavoy Allen yet. Coach McMillan, as of Wednesday, said he was hopeful for the game, which we're taping this Wednesday, is tonight for Lavoy. But this sounds like sooner rather than later for Lavoy. Do you see this being a matchup-based thing? Sometimes we see 22 minutes from Jefferson, and he's the best player on the bench, and sometimes we see him check in for a set or two, and he is out. But you've got Christmas, Jefferson, and potentially Lavoy when he's back, and that's a lot of minutes for bigs that I don't know how many they have to give.
I think that matchup is definitely what will determine who plays when and maybe how Rakeem Christmas responds to regular playing time, because I think that if he plays like he did in San Antonio, in Houston, Memphis, is that the first game he really played?
Memphis played really well.
So if you took a look at those three games and you said, man, Rakeem deserves to play, Nate would not argue with you. And I think he pretty much said when asked – you know, he's not going to tip his hand and say, this is my rotation for this game before the game. But it was clear to me that after those three, that Rakeem Christmas was a regular part of the rotation and the mix. And then in Atlanta, it wasn't really a good performance for him when he was in the first half. And I don't even know if you saw him in the second half, except I think he came in to defend the inbounds pass with 0.6 seconds to play. So he still utilized Rakeem. But I think you have to understand that Rakeem's never really played significant playing time in consecutive games, really at all, has not played regular rotation minutes in the NBA. So you can't expect every game he's going to be there. And now that you've seen what Rakeem can do, I think teams are aware of what his strengths are now, and they'll try to take those away. On the other hand, you know what Al Jefferson can do. You know what his strengths are, but you also kind of know what his limitations are as well. And I think the same probably could be said for Kevin Serafin. He might have less of a, you know, skill set than what Al has, but if you need an energy guy or a guy that's maybe going to come in and crash the glass, he can do that for you. But I think you basically look at the second units of teams and you decide, knowing that your starting group, if everyone is healthy, is pretty set right now. I do not see any changes. But Serafin, Lavoy, Al, of those three, you're probably going to play two. And then do you need two bigs on the floor in that second unit? The thing you might see more is a guy like C.J. Miles, maybe he comes out a little bit early and plays some backup four. Or the other thing is, if Thaddeus Young's not able to play in key offensive situations, then you've got C.J. maybe playing the four. And I know Nate Taylor wrote about this in the Indianapolis Star on Wednesday, but you're maybe playing more small with your starting group. So I do think that going into each game, if you're I know FanDuel's a big sponsor for the Pacers, but if you're a daily fantasy player, it's going to be a little bit hit and miss with some of those backup bigs for the Pacers.
Yeah, without a doubt. Rakeem Christmas is the best example that we have so far of why the Pacers purchased the Mad Ants and now own the Mad Ants, because he discussed how good it was for him, because when he goes – first of all, to small and quickly sidetrack. Have we decided whether we're calling it up to Fort Wayne or down to Fort Wayne? Because geographically it's up, but typically you say down when you're sending a guy to AAA.
I think I'm pretty good at saying up.
Okay. When they send
an Indiana guy, at least my geography fits in a little bit. If I say down, I quickly correct myself.
Right, but in baseball, down on the farm, sending a guy from the bigs to AAA, you're sending him down.
That's, yeah.
They're sending him up to Fort Wayne. When you're from here, and I've got my dad's side of the family's in Fort Wayne. It's just so very aware of where Fort Wayne is geographically.
Yeah,
it's kind of tough to call it down. But okay, back to the point. It's
you could say down to the G League.
Yeah,
or
are we calling
up
it that
to
yet?
Fort? Well, the DG League.
Yeah, down to the developmental league, the G League, up to Fort Wayne. Regardless, the reason the Pacers did this whole thing a couple of years ago was because now when Rakeem, for example, or any of these guys goes up to Fort Wayne, they are playing in a near identical system. The Pacers, the Mad Ants are running the same sets as the Pacers, the same type of terminology as the Pacers. So previously, you'd literally just go to Fort Wayne to get some playing time and to keep active and to, you know, be going against live bodies. But now when Rakeem does it, he's doing it and going through the same system that he's going to come back to. So that, I think, has been gigantic, and it's a reason that you've seen a player like him come in and step in immediately.
He also needed to stay fresh because you can only practice so much, and with him not being a part of the regular rotation, you almost forget things you do. I can remember And this is nowhere near the comparison, but, you know, as when I went to college and walked on the football team at Ball State, all I really did was practice. I didn't really play in the games, and I almost forgot, you know, all I ever used to do was be the quarterback and play sometimes defense as well. And when you're not playing, you almost forget that that's also, you know, the reason you're there is because you, when you play, you're capable of playing. And so it kind of got to the point where I never really, you know, I wasn't sure if I could do it anymore because I hadn't done it on the floor in real situations for so long. And the same could be said for Rakeem Christmas. Now, his scrimmages and the summer workouts and even the practices, they're probably a little more intense than what you would expect to see. But a lot of times you're just doing walkthroughs, so you're not getting a lot of that real work. And so just getting on the floor and being able to, you know, participate in game situations with Pacers offensive plays and sets, very big. And it's been big to have Rakeem. And I think if the Pacers over the next month or so, if you'd asked me in January what Rakeem Christmas's future is with this team, I'm not sure that I would have really had a great optimistic answer, because how could you? If he'd been on the team for a year and a half and they've not exactly had the number one seed in the Eastern Conference, it's a team that has struggled in different areas in the front court. And if the coaching staff did not think they could put him in there, then at what point do you, you know, every roster spot's valuable. So right now, with what we've seen in the last couple of weeks, I think Rakeem Christmas is someone who could develop. And I go back to what I think I've said on this podcast and what I said definitely on TV the first time Rakeem really contributed was Donnie Walsh compared him to Dale Davis when they were able to acquire him last year before the season started, and they liked the future and the potential that he had, and they thought his game compared a little bit with Dale Davis. So you'd love to have a Dale Davis for the next 10 years.
Yeah, I think that's a good comparison. I think the Pacers would certainly love for him to turn into that. Let's turn now into our pick three. The 2000s decade is coming up. The game is coming up. The decade's gone. The 2000s decade game is coming up on Sunday against the Miami Heat. By the way, these tickets are selling like hotcakes. If you're listening to this and you don't have one, I think there are a few left, but I would act immediately on Pacers.com/tickets. You can get resale tickets there, too, if they
don't
are
email me.
No, or me. Gave mine back. But this decade coming up gives us an opportunity. We did this for the 90s as well. To look at our three favorite moments from the 2000s decade. Again, these were a decade where you were covering it all of the decade, most of the decade, at least in some form from a news perspective, and I was still in my fandom years. So we look at this maybe slightly differently. And I know the same number one, so we're going to save that to the end. So I don't think we're saving or we're forgetting the big moment. That one is coming. But you kind of transitioned from the 90s to still being a fan to being a media member for a lot of the 2000s.
So I graduated from college in 2000, and that summer, which would basically be the summer of the finals team, is when I was starting to look for a job, and did not actually get a job until August. So I can remember watching the finals just kind of in my basement at home, and I didn't have a future set or a plan or really much money coming in, so did not really go to those games. But I remember the start of that, and then my first job was in Kentucky, only there for 15 months, and then spent 2001 to 2004 in Terre Haute. And Terre Haute was unique in that we didn't quote-unquote cover the Pacers with regularity, but if there was any local connection or perhaps just nothing going on a particular day, then we could request credentials. And obviously people are still into the Pacers in Terre Haute. It's just not something you can cover every day. So we'd come over once or twice a season, partially just because, you know, I wanted to try to maybe rub shoulders with some of the media in Indianapolis and get a little experience. And obviously it's fun to cover an NBA team. So I remember once I drove to Cincinnati and covered an Isaiah Thomas training camp at Xavier University from Terre Haute. And I think the reason was I wanted to my friend was in Cincinnati. So I was like, well, I can drive over there, get some coverage, get some interviews that we'll use that week, and then I can also stay and see my friend in Cincinnati. But the thing that I would remember most would be when I started working in Indianapolis. It was in that 2004-2005 season, and the second half of the season is when I was starting to work at Fox 59, and that was, of course, Reggie Miller's final season as well. And I remember Reggie's final game quite well, and I remember even the lead-up coverage to his final regular season home game and trying to put together features and spending a lot of time in the edit bays at Fox 59, because I just felt like this guy and this team that I'd been a fan of for so long, now I'm actually covering them on a day-to-day basis. And now I'm trying to put together features for our Sunday night sports show paying tribute to Reggie Miller. And Twitter wasn't around then, but I can remember reaching out even on television, I think, and maybe even through emails people had reached out. And there was a group, just kind of a small-town family band in Peru that had made this video or made a song, and it was like, Reggie, please don't go. And so I got the song from them, and then I put together this music video with shots from Reggie Miller. And it's like, Reggie, please don't go. Reggie, please don't go. Reggie, please don't go to the retirement home. You like my singing there?
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah. So I'm going to try to find that in the next few days. But I remember that final regular season home game and being in that press conference after the game, and the Pacers beat the Bulls by one or two and presented Reggie Miller with the car. So that final regular season home game, you didn't know what was going to happen in that playoff run. You obviously hoped at that point that Reggie could somehow help the team that had been through a tumultuous season go on a long run in the playoffs. But you had a feeling it wasn't a championship team. So that was kind of the Reggie Miller moment of that final season, the final home game. And that was a special night here at the Fieldhouse.
My pick is going to be 2004 Eastern Conference Finals, which obviously didn't go the way we had hoped, but this is Pacers and Pistons, and I think most people understood that whole year that it was probably going to be Pacers and Pistons, and then from then it was really a coin flip. The Pacers had home court advantage, and we know what happened in Game 2. My memory is Game 1. The Pacers beat the Pistons. You're in the Eastern Conference Finals. You've got a team that you think can win the championship, and you win Game 1 of the Eastern Conference Finals. Obviously, the series didn't go their direction. Detroit took it 4-2. All of those games, by the way, are hilarious to look at the scores, and you see why rule changes came quickly after that, because the Pacers, I think, won Game 1 78-74, and that was one of the higher-scoring games of the entire series. You had games where both teams were in the 60s. It was like low 70s to high 60s were the typical scores of those series. But just we talked a lot about, you know, the aura around those late 90s teams and the one that finally broke through, and even the ones that didn't break through yet. And while there wasn't necessarily a breakthrough for that 2004 Eastern Conference Finals team, the excitement, the how it, you know, was around the city of Indianapolis, growing up from Carmel, one of the suburbs, being around the area, just the excitement of having a team that you think can win your first NBA championship and going to the Eastern Conference Finals and, you know, being the home team for that was really exciting. And I guess the peak of that season, unfortunately, was Game 1 of the Eastern Conference Finals, but I still have pretty good memories from it.
And to your point about total score or scoring in games, that game I referenced was April 20th, 2005, 85-83. And before we started taping, and I had looked that up, and I said, that must have been a low-scoring game. But you're right, that was just kind of an average game in the NBA at that time. The Pacers outscore the Bulls 25-19 in the fourth quarter of that one. Yes, they win by two. Reggie finished with 12 points. Jermaine O'Neal, the leading scorer in that one, with 21. So the pick three is always one for Pat, one for me, and then one joint pick. And this is one of those games that it's crazy that it's such a memorable moment, considering it did not go in favor of the Pacers.
Right.
But it is one of those that was maybe the last real, true, I don't know, crazy Miller moments, because you think of so many of those plays were from 90s games. Yeah. When he hit, like, clutch shots, and you didn't know how many of those you would see. And it was Game 5, 2002, Pacers-Nets, and remember, the Pacers were the 8 seed and the Nets were the 1 seed.
And it was only a best-of-five series then, so Game
Correct.
5 was Game 7. And this is one of those I remember so vividly where I was, because I would have been – this was 2002, I would have been almost 12. And
that's impressive just saying that in 2000.
It's a little
you remember almost everything about it, and you're 12.
When we were talking the 90s highlights, the early 90s, it kind of blurry for me. The late 90s start to get a clearer picture. At this point, in some ways, I think like you're at the peak of your fandom when you're like 12, because you don't have enough rationality yet, but and everything's still kind of new. And I remember being over at my best friend's house, and they were all Pacers fans, of course, and the game wasn't going well for a good chunk of it. I don't remember specifics, but the Pacers got down, and it looked like they had no chance. And they turned the game off and put a movie on. So I went up into my buddy's room by myself and turned on his TV and watched the game by myself in my friend's room, and then came screaming and running down the stairs when we're talking. Reggie hits. What's so crazy, you mentioned some of these great moments and how one little thing changing, like 8 points, 9 seconds, needed so many things to happen for it to happen. I can't remember who was at the line, but whoever it was for the Nets, they're up three. They just need to hit one of these two foul shots and the game is over, and they miss both. And if any of that happens, one of Reggie's handful of best memories moments doesn't happen. He misses both free throws. Outlet pass comes to Reggie. He catches it a little in front of midcourt, spins, turns, fires up a shot, banks it in. That was in regulation, I think, to send it to the first overtime. And then he dunks later, I think, in the overtime.
The dunk was the kind of the follow-up. Like, right. Are you kidding me? I didn't even know Reggie could still dunk at that point.
I was watching on TV, and I guess I don't totally remember back then how you would go and get the radio call if you weren't listening at the time. Maybe I'm sure ESPN played it or something, and I remember – of course, before I knew Mark Boyle, besides listening to him, Dad, did you hear Mark Boyle's call? It was fantastic. And Mark, you know, who's someone, if you rank the guys 1 through 30 in the NBA who are, you know, neutral to fanboy being 1, neutral being 30, Mark's close to 30. He obviously gets excited in the big moments. You talk about Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead. But that was a moment where Boyle was just
so
all
you
out
were
exuberation.
Not. Wait, you were watching and listening?
No, I was watching the game, but I remember going back the next day, ESPN showing the highlights,
gotcha.
And you know how they put the radio call with it?
Gotcha.
And he just screams out yes like 10 straight times or something, and it was a little off his character, but it showed how big of a moment that was. And yeah, one of those moments you remember exactly where you were when it happened.
So exactly where I was Louisville, Kentucky, and for many of you that don't know, and maybe if you listen to this podcast now by knowing our pick three, a tradition that I've had with four or five of my friends that started late in college and has basically continued every year with maybe one or two exceptions over the last, 15 to 20 years has been to go to Louisville for the Kentucky Oaks. We don't always stay for the Derby. It's pretty expensive to go to the Derby, and it's not cheap to go to the Oaks, but we go Thursday, Friday, and that game was played on Thursday night of Derby weekend. And so me and two of my friends, at that point, we're just young, and I'm a young professional, still not really with much money, but thinking like I'm pretty cool. And so I had the two days off of work, and so I wasn't, you know, obviously covering it professionally, and I already referenced that I was working in Terre Haute, so it's not like we would have been, you know, been doing great, you know, local coverage of the Pacers at that point. So we just were walking around downtown Louisville trying to find a place to watch the game, because that had been the tradition, and it's kind of been able to stay, is that we always get together and we watch a Pacer game or a playoff game, I guess I should say, wherever we're at the night before the Oaks. And so we walk into this just hotel bar restaurant downtown Louisville, and we had yet to find, Yelp didn't exist. It wasn't like we knew all the restaurants. So we just, you know, have a couple drinks and order, I think, some chicken wings. And we sit there, and Tom Hammond is sitting right next to us. And it's like, well, this is kind of cool. And knowing that he's the guy who called so many of the great Reggie Miller games on NBC in the 90s. Well, he's in Louisville because he's working the Kentucky Derby coverage. And so he's not working that night, but he's doing the same thing we are. We're watching the game at the hotel bar. And all of a sudden, you know, at some point during the game, it gets good. And so we're just sitting there talking next to Tom Hammond. And we had our own basic play-by-play guy who's called some of the best games ever, sitting right next to us.
He could probably charge like $1,000 for that.
To sit
next to me and get my thoughts as the games are going.
Yeah,
and you got it for free.
And I wasn't like annoying, and we just kind of minded our own business, but it's always been something we've had to talk about is like, you know, hey, you guys, you want to get together and watch the playoffs with Tom Hammond tonight? But we haven't gone back to that location to see if he's gone back there, because he is still part of the Derby coverage. So that was fun. And the 3-point bank shot, you know, we went crazy. I can remember running around, and it wasn't even like, if you're picturing this packed, cool bar restaurant, there were probably like 10 people in there. My three friends, Tom Hammond, a couple of guys over in a corner playing darts. Like, it wasn't captivating the room.
Yeah.
But when I ran around after the 3-pointer, it did. And then I can remember the dunk as well. Like, how did he do that? And then it's just like, then they lost.
Yeah. I guess the fact that they were the 8 seed, they were supposed to lose. At the time, it stung. But it was nearly one of the biggest moments in NBA history. 8-1 still has only happened I think, less than five times. So nearly a fantastic moment there. The 2000s decade game is against the Miami Heat on Sunday. Let's wrap this up here in the next couple of minutes. We're doing this on Wednesday, so let's talk briefly. Pistons coming up, and then it's at Bucks back home against Miami. Three games coming up, three games that are around you in the standings, teams around you in the standings, and these are the games that separate you either up or down, these teams around you that are about a similar, you know, level of winning percentage that are, I think, the most important when you look back at the season when it's completed.
It's so weird how one game can kind of change what you feel about a team, and we should know better than that following this team and covering this team on a daily basis this season. But when we did not work the game on Fox Sports Indiana in Charlotte Monday, it was just, you know, another game that I kind of was just bored all night because I didn't have that much to do. But I can remember talking to Chris Denary before the game, and we said, well, if you win this game, you know, you have a chance to, you know, you've got Detroit and Milwaukee and then Miami and then New York. And Max Linewan, our producer, was like, you know, this could be like a 6 or 7 game win streak. And then you lose to Charlotte. And now you say, well, what if Detroit, you know, they're playing pretty well. What if they come in and win? And Milwaukee's been a tough place to play. And the Pacers haven't been a great matchup against the Bucks. And, of course, what you just said about the Heat. So you have to be careful to look too far ahead with this team. I mean, I caution, if the Pacers get a big win against the Pistons tonight, do not just think automatically that everything is, you know, going to be win moving forward. And if they have a big loss, I wouldn't necessarily be extremely frustrated. But you know, with only 19 remaining, that it is a pretty important time. And if you can go up two games with the tiebreaker on Detroit with a win on Wednesday, then you're in a pretty good position because the games continue to dwindle for everyone and they have less time to make up ground. Milwaukee's the game that I'm really scared of just a little bit because I just haven't seen or felt really good about Pacers-Bucks games over the last couple of years, and they're a little bit like Charlotte in that if they're going to make the playoffs, and that's what all of those people in that organization, on that team, I mean, they went into this season fully expecting to be a playoff team, and it's still very much possible. I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens to a team like Chicago. Do they still hang around, or do they run out of gas, or do they have a little bit of problems here, and does maybe Milwaukee take one of their spots? So it's an interesting week, and I think that is really important for these home games moving forward to take care of business. The Pacers have played better on the road, but they're still not a team that you go into a road game against a good team with a great deal of confidence. So big game against the Pistons.
All right, I think that about wraps it up here. If you're listening before the game against Detroit, it's an 8 o'clock tip. You can catch pregame coverage with Jeremiah and myself at 7:30, Fox Sports Indiana, and across the Bankers Life Radio Network. If you're listening after that game, same deal, 8 o'clock against the Milwaukee Bucks.
I do want to say one thing quickly, Pat, and often on Pacers Weekly, you ask me what fans have to look forward to on Fox Sports Indiana. We've been working on this for a couple of weeks, but halftime of the game against the Pistons and then again at halftime of the Bucks game, a two-part feature on one of our personal favorites, someone that we can call a co-worker and friend as well, Darnell Hillman, Dr. Dunk. We're going to take a look back and ask him some questions about something that not a lot of people know about. We had to dig into the NBA archives and actually make a special request through the league to get some of this footage that Darnell Hillman was an ABA dunk contest champion, and the format was completely different. It's not like the dunk contest is today. Before the game against the Pistons, the Pacers are going to honor and recognize Glenn Robinson III with Darnell Hillman and with Fred Jones, and then at halftime of this game on Fox Sports Indiana at halftime of Friday, the two-part series reliving Darnell Hillman's dunk contest championship. So if you are going to the game, or if you catch this before the Pistons game and you can set your DVR, it should be a good watch.
All right, that should wrap it up for this week's Sideline Guys podcast. For Jeremiah Johnson, I'm Pat Boylan. We will talk to you next week.